I'd like to once again thank all for coming and helping make this halacha series such a tremendous kiddush hashem. Also, a special thank you to Rav Marburger and Rav Cohen and Business Halacha Institute for putting together this important series together with Madison. In these days of Sfira, in between Pesach and Shavuos, we count each day towards Kabbalah Sefirah and prepare ourselves for that moment. The Ramban actually refers to these days as the Chol HaMoed between Pesach and Shavuos. And as we spend each day going about our daily business, it can be easy to lose sight of the true accomplishments that we are trying to achieve. By coming here tonight and hearing from Rav Cohen, we are showing that our daily lives are a chelik of our Avodas HaKodesh as well. And we understand that our ishtadlus is only the means to allow the Rebbeinu Shalom to be mashpia on us to succeed in our business ventures. This strengthening of our emunah, even as we live our daily lives, will certainly help in our goal of being ready for Kabbalah Sefirah on the highest level possible. Tonight's topic is partnerships in halacha and is relevant to anyone involved in any type of business. It is a circumstance and challenge faced by us all as we invest and create joint ventures together with our colleagues and friends. This is particularly relevant during these days of Sfira, when we try to strengthen our dealings in order with Veda and look for any ways possible to avoid strife and misunderstandings among ourselves. Certainly, by having some basic guidance in what is accepted by Allah in these areas will go a long way in helping us deal properly when faced with these common situations. We have the special privilege of hearing from Rav Chaim Cohen tonight. Rav Cohen, in addition to being the founder and dean of the Business Halacha Institute and its associated base, Hiroa Eitz Chaim, is also Dayan of Kahal Hadas Yeshurun of Washington Heights and Morad Asra of the Gera Beis Medrash in Flatbush. All due respect, Rav Chaim Cohen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your kind words. I will discuss this topic without further ado. Just, I would like to share with you an anecdote. This goes back 40 plus years, which I feel 40 plus years, four of you. Before I got married, I remember the story like today. We were then about purchasing our apartment in Yerushalayim, and I was walking into this lawyer's office. The fellow was on the phone, and he made a comment on the phone to somebody else, and for some reason it still sticks in my memory, in my mind. And he told him as follows. He told him in Hebrew, "Ata yodea, you know, shutafut, meaning partnership, we call it a kusha chazafis." So for those who don't know Yiddish, I will try to explain what it is. A kusha chazafis, so conceptually speaking, means that you take something which is not kosher, but you give it a hechsher. You certify it as kosher. What did he mean to say by that? It's very interesting. What he meant to say by that is as follows, that in principle, partnership, by all criteria, is due to faith. There are many odds against it. Human nature, sometimes it's the law, the structure of the deal, and so on and so forth. Nevertheless, the Torah permitted a partnership. So that's what he called it, a kusha chazafis. Very interesting. Anybody who deals with law, and I don't need to tell you that, you are in the profession, knows that we talk about partnership, we're talking about human beings, law, and the structure of the deal. Those are the three basic elements that make partnership be. And each of those categories, in its own right, is complex, not simple at all. First of all, if you talk about human beings, everybody has a different perception. If you're talking about the deal, people have a different perception of what the deal is. So the structure of the deal, which is consequently the outcome of that idea of partnership, is already at the outset somewhat complex because everybody has a different perception, for the most part. This is where you people, and very often we too, come into the picture. We try to structure it at the outset in such a fashion to avoid future conflict, unless you are a super lawyer and you know where the holes are so that you know that you invite further business. That's something else. Though I don't have to give you this kind of advice. Forgive me this comment. But in all honesty, what it is all about is to structure it at the outset in such a fashion that eventually it ends up between the parties in a strife and hopefully not in court, you should be able to have enough tools to work it out. So people should understand. That's not me.
No, you hadn't heard the microphone.
I shouldn't speak like a Jew, you mean. Okay, so I didn't try to do that. There we go. So, let me first explain a simple principle. Let me explain a simple principle, and this is as follows. We live in a world of cooperation, and there is a misconception as far as cooperation is concerned in regard to halacha. There might be, again, what did I do wrong?
Where is the expert?
It might very well be that corporations in halacha have a certain status as far as Hilchos Ribis are concerned. If there is Ribis or not Ribis, according to some poskim, I don't need to introduce you on that one. I don't want to address Ribis. That's not the topic of today. A corporation, in whatever structure you, in whatever way you structure, by definition, determines the dynamics, the rules upon which people agree to be part of them. Now, having said so, we need to address an important element, and this is, after all, the law of the land, famously known as Dinul Malchusa, has a lot to say here. It's not only the Dinul Malchusa as such, as a legal entity. It's much more than that. It is how people understand this Dinul Malchusa to be in actual life. How to interpret it. We call it minogam din, custom of the land. And therefore, how people would usually approach business, terms of any kind of deal, this is exactly how halacha would view this land. In other words, if we have an interpreter where cooperation is part of the interpreter, very often it is, so there's no question about it that the Nayonim will have to take in consideration what does the law of the land say in this particular case. It doesn't mean that this is the last word in this subject, but it's certainly something to reckon and consider. That's number one. Number two, I would like to point out here, and I feel that this is, in my opinion, helpful advice for all of us. When you write a contract, a partnership contract, please be careful how you write it. Since, and I don't have to tell you, once it comes to any kind of dispute, based in, similar to judges in the court, will, so to say, proofread what does it say in the contract. And as such, every word will be interpreted in this other way. Does it mean at the end of the day that we are going to take the words of the contract to be the last word on this subject? Not necessarily. We will incorporate other factors as well. Nevertheless, it's very important. You write a contract, it should be written in a fashion way that basically will have the ability to adjudicate the case in all honesty, true to the intention as it was at the outset. That's number one. Now, coming to the subject of partnership itself. You see, in my opinion, partnership, or shutra, it's called in Hebrew, is probably the most fascinating subject in Chosha Mishpat. And the reason for this is because you have here, for lack of a better term, a conglomerate. A conglomerate. It's really a conglomerate of different subjects in halacha. People work together, for example, poorly work for each other, have a status of a poet, of a worker, or a couple for that matter. I don't want now necessarily define the status of the person as far as this is concerned in Hilchos Shiros Baalim, in the laws concerning hiring workers. But what is important to understand is that people who act as partners, active partners, are already poalim. And even if only one of those people is a worker, is a partner, the other one being the investor, certainly the one who is working is a poet, is a worker, and therefore subject to the law of stress power. So that's one part of the conglomerate. If you have other parts, there are certain liabilities here. Well, liabilities in the classic definition of Chazal, it is shomer, a guardian. If I take your money, I'm a guardian, I'm a shomer. And therefore, the laws of shomrim also play a role here. Furthermore, there are subjects that are unique to the halakha of shutfim, to the halakha of partnership. Namely, the way how to establish a partnership. We know very well that in order to establish any kind of legal relationship in halacha, you need to have kinyon, mode of acquisitions, which are extremely rigid. The question will be, how do we establish kinyonim that make this partnership valid? What are we going to use here that one will not be able to back out based on the premise that there was nothing binding here? So we have these three elements that we just discussed. One is the concept of a poem, second of a shoma, and the third one, kinyon. I use this Hebrew term, which I assume people are familiar with. So those three elements come together. Now, having established those three principles, the question will be, what are the terminologies used to dissolve this partnership? The dissolution of partnership sometimes is extremely difficult. Regardless if you're talking about sharing of profits or sharing of losses. The duration of the partnership, if it was not clearly established, how are we going to determine according to halacha? Okay, so let's therefore start with the beginning. The first subject to be discussed are kinyonim. You see, in today's commerce, the non-tangible but I say non-tangible I plead innocence. The non-tangible, what I refer to here is, it's not only money in the modern fashion as we know it. When I say non-tangible, I mean also matters that have to do with futures and with the very business of this company here, buying, selling mortgages, insurance, and so on and so forth. Major business. Then, in terms of kinyonim, we have a concept which is called dolo shaloi b'loim, something which is not yet here. It's not tangible because simply it's not yet existing. We're not even talking about what halacha terms as dolo she'ein gufo mamash, which would be, as I said earlier, today's money very often. The transfer of ownership of all those kind of stuff, very difficult. Halachically speaking, how would we establish altogether that people become partners, halachically speaking, when you're talking about matters where kinyonim in its original structure are not binding. The answer to this is one sentence. We have this beautiful cantic that is called Sutanta. Sutanta means that we have a principle introduced in Aloha that if people establish some kind of kinyon, notary positions that are the norm, become the accepted norm, then this kind of Sutanta could be effective according to many poskim. You could look it up in Siman Reish Aleph, the two over there. Many poskim who hold that in this particular case, even something which is dovah shaloi b'elohim, even something which is not yet, even something which is not tangible, anything which usually, according to lack of better term, orthodox norms, the kinyan would not be validated, nevertheless, it could achieve. The din of Malchusus many times establishes those norms. There's a confusion sometimes between people between the concept of Dinar Machus and Setunta. But at the end of the day, from our end, from the Lachic perspective, once it becomes a Setunta, once it becomes something which is the accepted norm, the king is here. In fact, in Shulchan Aruch, we have three different opinions about how we establish a partnership. And at the end of the day, and I'm not going now to explain to you those three shittas, those three different opinions. What is really important for us is that for all practical purposes today, any responsible basin would rule that if a contract was signed and the contract is validated usually in norms of business, then the partnership takes effect, regardless of what we are dealing with. Even if we're talking about mortgages, about titles, we're talking about transferring assets which are not tangible, doesn't matter. Futures, doesn't matter. If it is signed in a contract, halacha will accept it as a validated partnership. And therefore the partners become now responsible to each other. By this they become partners. Now, as I said earlier, we have also a situation where people invest what we call usually the working partner, and there is a partner who is the investing partner. So then in this particular case, we have the working partner to be a poet. In this particular case now, he becomes a worker. Now there's a unique halacha in skills parlance, in hiring a worker, which is a worker is in this other sense considered like a slave. And then, Torah doesn't want you to be a slave. Consequently, we have the famous principle that poel chozer be'emtzayon. A poel could terminate his relationship with the employer even without further notice. So really what could happen here, in such a situation, we could have here a very bizarre setup when the hired person to do the job, if he doesn't like it, one day could get up and say, have a good day. I don't want to work further, and therefore, I have to terminate my relationship. One could say, but you signed the contract. And once you signed the contract, therefore, you remain obligated to me because of the contract. Question, it's not so simple. Here we have again a major argument between halakhic authorities. If a kinyan in such a particular case would fortify, would make stronger the position of the investor telling here the worker, look, after all being that we made an extra kinyan, we made an extra modal acquisition, therefore you become obligated anyway, which depends on a lot of the basket, it's not so simple. How to beware of it? There are halachic, how should I say, instruments that could work on that, but I'm not going to inform you about all my secrets. Those are in the back pocket. So there are ways how to handle it. But it's not so simple. It's not simple, I just want to tell you. Because you don't want to end up at the end of the day with a contract that is not enforceable in basement. You don't want to be in such a situation. So therefore, once you write such a contract, it's always smart advice to consult somebody who knows something about halacha. That in this situation, the worker should not have, or the person who is managing this company should not have this this kind of opportunity to back out, just give it because the Torah gave him the leeway of backing out of the Pope. I want to tell you a story of today. That's what happened in the morning today. Coincidental or not coincidental? Two people came over, four people. But it's a classic case. There'll be four people came over. One who bought a deal. The deal was to buy merchandise and to sell it. He didn't want to invest the money. The money is to be invested here were over $1 million, and he didn't, for whatever reason, invest it. Not that he doesn't have the money for that. He's not a Porsche, not a poor person, but business calculations. He approached somebody else he makes business with. And the other person, the other party, was willing to invest $1 million, $1.2 million. At the end of the day, what happened was that part of the merchandise, I mean, everything was sold, but not in the time frame that they were expecting to have it done. Part of the merchandise also was sold, which party A, the one who brought the deal, understood. Party A, for his understanding of the terms of the deal there, said, well, you sold part of the merchandise, and I understood that if you sell this part of the merchandise, I should profit with you. Said party B, nothing happening. Certainly, if you sell part of the merchandise which I deliver to you upon demand, you have the right to sell it, and then you have to give me a share of the profit. But if I sell it, no. It's completely mine, and I could do with whatever I want, and therefore, I don't have to share the profits. I hold the profit for myself. What was the question? The question was a simple question. The question was, when B, party B, who was approached to invest the money, what was it? Is he simply a person who was given the opportunity to buy merchandise and then to sell it on to party A, to give him the opportunity to make business with him? Who was your partner? Was he a part of his party A on all the business? Or wasn't he? But they never discussed it in detail. And therefore, roughly speaking, being that party B invested all the money, even if it would have been, for arguments like this, even if it would have been that for argument's sake, halacha, even if it would be for argument's sake, that party B intended to be a partner, now listen to this, intended to be a partner, but at the end of the day decided, you know what, why do I need to have A as my partner? Let me buy just for myself. Being there was no Kenyan done here to establish his partnership, party B could keep this merchandise for himself. Was it a nice move on his part? Not necessarily. But as Aloha says, you could be upset with it, but there it stops. Being that we didn't have here the proper kinyon, the proper mode of acquisition that should establish the shibudim, the obligations of both parties, consequently, party B backed up. Have a good day. Now, certainly, Bezmi didn't say that. Bezmi said that there was never an intention to be a part of his party A in the classical sense, in the classical term of the word. Okay. But even if it would have been like this, still, party A does not really have a legal claim. All because of very simple reason. Because they did not establish the proper kinyoni, and because certainly they did not discuss how to handle the situation if there's any kind of a conflict. And therefore they end up in basin. They're still making business with each other. It has nothing to do with it. But you're talking here about a claim of approximately $150,000, which could have been avoided if the proper precautions were taken in the beginning. Okay. Now, I would like to tell you another story. And this is, I think, also happens quite often. Let's say you get a business venture in a game when if one party is the one to invest, the other party the one to deal with this whole situation, to deal with the business itself. And things are not working out as expected. Question now here is, can party A, can the investor, or better, could the manager of this business, of this deal, turn to the investor and say, well, let's save the business. And I want you to invest more money. And I want you to invest more money. Or, as the investor says, well, I don't want to throw good money after bad money. And the question is it really good money throwing after bad money, or isn't it? To what extent is an obligation on behalf of the investor to add money to a deal that was already existing? Again, if everything would have been written out, specified in clear terms, then we have a document that guides us. But I don't have to tell you that even if it's written out, nevertheless, it might very well be that the whole thing took an unexpected turn where party B says, no, I'm not willing to do that anymore. You know what? You have to invest as well. Or, you know what? I will tell you something. We had made up a particular share of profit at the end of the day. Then you will have now to invest from what the expected return would have been. You will now have to invest in the business here. Even if I forward money, nevertheless, you will have give up from your share of the profits so that at the end of the day, I shouldn't be the party to suffer the loss. What's the loss in such a situation? This matter is a major, major argument in the posting, but I will tell you the bottom line of it. The bottom line is, it's not so simple. It might very well be that the manager might force the investor to add money. Might very well be. If it's clear that he did not manipulate or did not in any way behave in a negligent fashion, he might very well force the investor to add money. Will he have to give up from his profits? So this is, again, dependent on the different opinions in halacha. But those who hold that he doesn't have to give up, because this was expected to be on his part that he should invest further. Many would say otherwise. Many would say that it depends on the situation, what we call umdun, meaning that we have to size up here what was the understanding, what was the interpretation of the deal. For example, if the manager of the deal is a poor person, poor is relative. Understanding the nature of the deal, we understand that he would never enter this deal to share here the losses in this size or give up from his profits here. Then in this case, a lot of the rule that no, he doesn't have to give up. Otherwise, if it's really so that he in principle is a person who has means, and therefore it could be expected that he should share here in the losses as well, with the expectation that eventually there will be profit at the end, then he could be forced to do it. So in this particular case, basically, we'll have to invest in itself to understand the characters of the people, to understand the nature of the deal, and then, according to this, determine how it should be done. By the way, there's sometimes a situation where people argue, well, you know, when I give you the money, it is really to be understood like what we call in halacha an iskah. Now, we're not talking about heter iskah. In a heter iskah, certainly, the return to the investor is clear, whatever they establish between themselves. In principle, independent of the deal, although it's called an iskah, an investment, nevertheless, the return is predetermined in this other way, and hopefully it's secured to a great extent. Here we're talking about iska in a different fashion. We're talking about iska in the more classical sense. Nevertheless, being that in principle what we understand here, it's an iska. So here happens a very interesting twist. The twist is as follows. The regular iska, as Chazal understand it, is that party B in this case with the investor, forwards money to party A with the manager of the deal. Part of the money immediately turns into a loan, which means that this money, which was forwarded to the manager, now is basically his money, therefore invested as his money into the deal, owed to the investor. And therefore now, we are going to look at him as an equal partner, more or less, with the investor. So it's not like the previous scenario that I described to you, when I, means the best investor, party B, investor takes a manager to handle the business, but where the manager basically has no personal investment in the business, and consequently we have these different scenarios that I told you earlier, the dynamics of the deal. Here in principle, both are shutfit, really shutfit, already right away, by the virtue of Israel, by the virtue of having given here the person share in the investment itself, having it turned the manager to an equal partner with the investor. And therefore, at the end of the day, again, if, for example, it is expected that if there is another roll call for another investment here, he will be called exactly in the same fashion like the original investor, because in principle, there's no difference. Where should you take the money from? Well, as I forwarded the money to you, it might very well be, again, depending on the circumstances, that you may be demanded to produce money for someone else, if this is really within the framework of the business itself. So that's what we didn't agree. Here we have the interesting twist of Iska, where Iska turns the manager into an equal investor. And as an equal investor, he'll have equal responsibilities for the rest of the deal. Having said so now, let me talk a little bit about the dissolution of the partnership. If there's a clear time frame for the business, so then let's go back to the very beginning. Time frame of the business is very good. It means that whoever invested money, he cannot back out. However, what happens about being active in the business? Being active in the business. You see, here we come back to the principle we discussed in the beginning. If we do say that partners are pa'alim, workers to each other, and there's a halachic rule that the worker could back out in the middle, so then, although he cannot take out the money invested, but he might well argue and say, well, I want to continue working. So unless having here taken precautions before that it should not happen, and using, again, halakhic instruments that would prevent that here the partner should say, I will stop working, I have better interests to pursue, it might never be that he will be entitled to do so. And this is a precarious situation. It is certainly true, when you're talking about investments, that sometimes you have a situation when it is clear, according to the dynamics of the marketplace, that although at the outset a time was given, but the opportunity to make money is not existent anymore. Halacha rules in such a situation that although time frame was expected to be at the end of the date, until then the investment is running, but if the circumstances in the market change so drastically that it's self-understood that they never It was like it's running out. The business is running out, so then the time frame originally established is already immaterial, because it's like we don't have any more the opportunity to make this business anymore. Certainly, it's impossible to demand from any partner to change the investment to something which was not originally intended. If, although it might be similar, but it was not originally intended, so then we are saying that endeavor came to its end, and therefore you cannot be forced to do that. Now, what happens if you would like to dissolve the partnership in such a fashion where one would like to take over the business and the other one should be bought out, which is the famous principle of Budolim. which is very, very, how should I say, appealing to some people. And inviting very often quite different problems. Okay, so let's discuss it from an halachic perspective. There's one principle in good argument which you need to remember. And this is good argument really applies in the original halacha to Yoshi, to an estate. In other words, when you have a partnership which was established not by people in a voluntary fashion, but the people became partners just by virtue of the halacha, by the inheritance. And therefore there's a machlokes haposkim, there's an argument between the poskim, if there's altogether a right for any of the partners in the regular partnership to say good argument. Do we pass them like this? Then I must say, the majority of poskim say it applies even today. But you know, I don't know if I have from my good friend Sfardim here, some here, there's some great Sfardim poskim who say that you could say Kimli, you know, you could say, I don't want to make good or good because, you know, I have the right to do that because the poskim will say otherwise. Is it so? Isn't it so? I don't know. Depends on the basis and how they would rule. But it's not a thing. That's one thing. But yes, for all practical purposes, people would apply good argument even by Shuf, even by regular partnership which was established voluntarily. Second principle. Good argument means that we have here an asset which by definition should not be divided. Why shouldn't it be divided? Is it because it's in the best interest of the partnership? No, not necessarily. It might be that it's not in the best interest of partnership, it's in the best interest of one person who has enough to be a partner with somebody else, which is in itself is not a good reason, halakhically speaking, to dissolve the partnership. You see, even if you have a situation when you suspect that your partner is stealing or doing something, which you call in halakhic terms pshia, negligence, it's not so simple that you could dissolve the partnership, not at all. Halakhically speaking, it might be that other person will be liable for whatever he was negligent in, but the partnership is still intact. So this is not simple altogether. So why would one want, when would one have the right to demand good argument? It's when what we call in the halacha, we're talking about assets which are in principle not dividable. What do you mean it's not divided? What makes it not divided? The answer is that after you divide it, it would not be in the same character like it was at the outset. Then this is called to be non-divided. Now, obviously everybody understands if you take a stone, a diamond, and if you cut it, it's not the same diamond anymore. That's for argument's sake, right? Then it's not divided. Maybe, right? If, maybe yes, maybe not. I don't know. For sure, in such a situation, the remote persons at least, that if there's a major loss, by dividing it, it's considered to be also non-divided. Some say the range is about 20%. Okay? If you would cheapen the value of the asset by 20% would be enough reason to say well, that's not a dividable asset. Halacha uses a term that still is shmoy olof, it's still called the original kind of an asset. Let's say you have a complex of apartments where you would divide apartments, so even if you divide them, nevertheless, still the apartments, those houses, are still considered to be with the original name. But if you're talking about businesses, real, real businesses, when, for example, and I will tell you, this is always what I grapple with. Let's say if we divide the business, and we divide the assets, but the name of the business will be changed, and part of the goodwill of the business, or maybe a major part of the value of the business, is the goodwill. So therefore, if we change now, if we now divide between us, so then in effect, if one of the two parties will have now to assume a different name, so then it might be very well argued that this is a loss, a major loss, that we would therefore determine this to be a non-dividable asset. How does it work then? Well, in truth, for practical purposes, it's not so difficult. One thing is for sure. It's a two-way street. In other words, if you come and say, I want to buy you out, you have to give him the option to buy you out as well. It's not a one-way street. You cannot say just, you know, I want to buy you out, but you cannot buy me out, that kind of thing. Similarly, too, the other way around. You cannot say, please, I offer you to buy me out. It doesn't work either. So it has to be both ways. Halachically speaking, bottom line is, even if I need to take, if I'm a buyer and I propose a price that is even higher than the market value, that's fine, no problem, no problem. And then, yes, if the other party is not willing to buy me out, I will have to pay the higher price, that's not a problem. What I cannot do, obviously, I cannot offer less than the market value, that I cannot. Now, what could be, certainly, I have the right to say I would like to buy out, and the other person would say, fine, okay, very good, you offer me to buy out, I would like to buy you out. I don't have the money now in cash. I would like to take a mortgage, I have to borrow the money. Oh, you have to borrow the money. That's not good enough. Could you pay right away with cash? Halacha is no, you don't pay right away with cash. If he could produce the money from other sources, that's fine, as long as he could reproduce it. Would we give him time? In principle, yes. For all practical purposes, at the end of the day, any banker would give him some time. Certainly, it's proper and right that if you write a partnership agreement at the outset that you already have specified the terms of this buyout, how it should work, I don't have to give you advice how to do that. You know, much better than I know. But if you specify the terms, so then, at any rate, whatever there should be, those terms work. But, halachically speaking again, yes, he doesn't have to come up with the cash right away. It has to be within a reasonable time that Baden would determine such a situation. And yes, he doesn't have to have the cash available for himself. Even if he produces his money from somewhere else, he could do that. And even, halakhically speaking, that it would remain. If he's going to buy it out from you in order to sell it further, he could still do it. Even if he doesn't intend to keep it. He buys it out because he has somebody else who is willing to buy it from him. And maybe this is one of the ways how he's producing his cash. Still fine. That's halakhically reminds how it would be at the end of the day. And you could not deny it this one. So this is, in short, the principle of good oi ogut. Any questions, Sina? Did I put you asleep?
Not yet. What happens if the person who's buying is given time by Beis Din and doesn't come up with the money in that amount of time?
Well, there's no good argument. Then he could buy him, out. There's no good argument.
The original of the price?
Yes.
Then
he could start again. Then he starts again.
Starts again?
Yes. No, then he could reduce the price. We could buy him out, certainly. No question about it. Now, if I still have time, do I still have time? Yes or no?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, yes.
When you're doing good ogut, and you have one partner, let's say you said you're going to investor on an active partner, so how would that work in a place like that? The active partner is...
Doesn't matter. Good ogut has nothing to do, if you're talking about situation of an active partner, not active partner, it applies to all kinds of partners. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. Yes, no? Yeah, okay. Generally speaking, what happens in the middle of a deal, in the middle of a partnership? The contract was written, the terms are clear, one day one partner calls up the other one and says, you know, I would like to now a little bit to handle our business differently. Does he have the right to do that? Certainly not. The terms are clearly established. What happens in case that he does not have either response from the other party? And therefore he goes forward and changes the way of business. Do we say that the fact that the other party did not respond to it in fashion, it's considered to be that he did it with permission? So here again, we have an argument between Paschim and between the halachic authorities. If this is considered to be an acceptance or not, because it might be that the other party will say, well, I didn't bother even to enter because we have a clear conflict otherwise. But what happens in that situation when he changed it once, and let's say the result of that change brought in a profit or a loss, whatever it should be, but let's say a profit. And consequently, the partner who was quiet in response now is still quiet, and therefore the partner who changed based on his assumption that being the partner the first time kept quiet, so therefore he agrees to that change of terms. So here everybody agrees that the one who changed could say, well, if he would not have wanted me to change, he should have resisted right away the second time. In other words, let it go one time, and therefore not, at the end of the day, protesting against it is enough of a reason for the partner to change to assume that the other partner agrees to that, and therefore could not continue doing business with that particular change. I will tell you something, an interesting story. What happens if people are active in the gray market? The gray market means a market which is tolerated by the authorities, but it's not completely legal. Or maybe it's not legal at all, but it's tolerated. Gray market. Many people make business in the gray market. What happens if I invest money with somebody who is in the gray market, or my partner with somebody who is in the gray market? And even in the gray market, there are certain established norms of how business are being conducted, is conducted. And here, for whatever reason, one of the partners deviates from the norms. And this is a very interesting question. Do we say that being that he is not acting, they are not active in an area of business that is completely legal, that therefore, you know, by definition, you don't handle this kind of situation with regular norms? Or do we say, no, even the irregular has certain norms? So again, this is a question in the poskim. Some say that if you know at the outset that this particular person is, you know, he's a risk taker, you know that he's active in a kind of a business where risk is inherent, and therefore he takes some irregular ways how to make business. You cannot argue and say, well, what you did was not up to normal business terms. So now, if you're talking about gray market, for example, my personal opinion would be gray market is its norms. But if you're talking about the kind of business which have inherent risks, that could be different. Because in that particular case, being that you know it's a risky kind of business, and you are willing to invest in a business that is very risky, so therefore you accepted to have this person handle those assets in such a fashion which might be not the norm, because by definition people don't usually invest money which is high risk. And therefore, it's very difficult to say in such a situation that you deviated from a particular norm of business. No questions? Very interesting. Okay. You're using me. That's extraordinary.
Rebecca,
yes.
Can Going back to Buddha, I'll go for a minute. Can you waive that? In other words, can you in the agreement, can you say, I give up the right of partition? I won't claim that?
What can they talk about?
Regular shudras. Can one shudra...
In the middle of time?
No. At the beginning, you sign an agreement, and each one says, I'm...
Before the agreement?
Part of the agreement. It's written in the agreement.
Like what?
That I won't make any claim for good oak. I won't make any claim for partition.
Yes.
It's enforceable?
Certainly. If there's anything, it has to be written correctly. But if it's written correctly, certainly any term, any tonight, could be established if it's all written correctly. Yes.
How does Gurudev really apply in a 70-30 partnership?
That has to be written correctly. What I'm saying is as follows. You are lawyers.
I believe you, but I don't know what it means to do it correctly or incorrectly.
Correctly means to say that you need to use legal instruments that, in effect, tie the hands of the other party to forfeit his rights of Buddha. Okay? That's what it means. Yes?
How does Gurudev apply in a 70-30 partnership? Can 70% partner tell 30% partner? It's not.
Yes, so that's
what it is.
Even
though
it's
inherently not a fair deal, right?
But it's fair. Fair is a very relative term, you know? Yeah. Yes. Anything else? That's it. Thank you very much.
I can't believe there's a lot.